Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, taking a look at space today with Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place. He's a faculty associate in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy, and also with Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton. Lots going on in space, and we've got the Galileo scope to talk about as well with them today, and a whole lot more. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Jim Lattice, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
And Tom Hall, great to see you again.
Morning, Larry.
Well, we've got lots that we can talk about. Let's talk about the Galileo scope. I've been having a lot of fun with our Galileo scope. Are they selling?
Oh, they're very popular. Yeah, lots of people want them, and so far I've heard lots of success stories. Nobody's lost the littlest lens under the couch yet that I've heard. It takes a little bit of putting together, but very little bit of putting together, and then you've got yourself a really nice $15 telescope. And I took it out just last night. We have a house guest, and I took my 13-year-old son out. We decided to go out and check Jupiter's moons, which are going to do something a little interesting later in the week that we might want to talk about. Perfect mm-hmm. for viewing with the Galileo scope. So we went out and set it on the sidewalk and looked at Jupiter for a little while. It's really just a super lightweight, high quality telescope for $15.
Yeah, and anybody can order one.
We're selling them at Space Place. Mm-hmm. You can also order them from the website at galileoscope.org. Mm-hmm. And we have them over the counter at Space Place for $15. I hear the price is going up. I haven't heard that officially, but it might be that the next batch will be a little more expensive.
Well, I tell you, they're really nice and a lot of fun. And the fact you can take them apart and put them back together again is
it's a really cool. Great project for kids to do. We've been doing them at workshops at Space Place and at some of our Universe in the Park programs mm-hmm. over the summer. We still have a few more workshops. We're going to be doing a couple in Milwaukee in coming weeks, and so we've had pretty good success with groups building them, parent and child groups, or mm-hmm. or kids who are older than about 10 can handle it if they follow directions. It's very capable. It's really sophisticated optically. It has a modern eyepiece design. It isn't. Some people have asked me, is this what Galileo saw? And the answer to that is yes and no, because it's about the same magnification as Galileo's early telescopes. So you get an idea of how much he could see when he looked at, say, Jupiter and its moons or whatever. But the optical quality is 21st century. And so although the magnification is about the same, the image quality is light years beyond what Galileo
light
had.
Years. Yeah. Well, you mentioned Jupiter, and you and Tom were talking about Jupiter a little bit. Tom, what's going on with Jupiter this week?
Well, two nights from now, the evening of September 2nd, going into the morning of September 3rd.
Early morning of the 3rd, yeah.
And it's right around midnight, as I recall, when the event happens. Something that only occurs perhaps a dozen times, I guess, within a century. And even fewer times, depending on the area that you're at, you don't have many opportunities to see this happen. All four of Jupiter's moons essentially disappear from view. Two rotate behind the disk of Jupiter, two rotate in front, and effectively you're left with none of the normal view that you have of the Galilean moons of Jupiter visible, and they'll be gone for about a two-hour transit that evening, right around that time.
So around midnight, then, is it, Tom?
Jim has the exact times here.
Jim, what have you got there?
Well, if you were to go out and start looking at 12:15, you would just catch the disappearance of the last moon,
okay.
Which I think happens a few minutes later. So you might want to give yourself an extra 5 or 10 minutes to get set up and that sort of thing. But then it would be kind of fun to see the moons and be watching them and then see the last one of them disappear, which a little bit after 12:15. And then I think the first reappearance happens, I did a rough calculation, at about 1:25
okay.
In the morning. So if on that morning of the early morning of the 3rd, you have the option to go out there and take a look at that, that should be kind of fun. So, as Tom says, it's kind of rare. It's a little bit like an eclipse in the sense that it doesn't last so long that If you aren't at the right place at the right time, you won't be able to see it. Like in Europe, it'll be daylight already. They won't be able to.
They won't be able to see it.
So it's kind of a special thing.
And where do we look in the sky, Jim?
Just about due south at that point, right around midnight. Okay. It'll be due south and 30 degrees or 40 degrees up from the horizon.
Yeah,
it'll be the brightest thing there. Pretty easy to pick out.
Yeah, it should be really prominent.
And the moon is quite close. How close does the moon pass? But at that point,
that's pretty close to full moon.
Yeah, it's waxing pretty heavily now, and it'll be very close to Jupiter. But you shouldn't have to worry too much about light wash in small telescopes. Jupiter's bright enough. But even though the moon's close, this is a very observable event.
Yeah, it's a day before full moon, so the moon there'll be a lot of moonlight that night. So that might make it actually easier to set up your Galileo scope on. By the way, galileoscopes come equipped to fit onto a standard photo tripod, which is a very important way. I take it you've discovered that.
Yes, I've leaned it on our boat hoist, and I could do. I can do that, but it's a lot better when it's when you've got it on a something a little more stable.
Yeah, but it'll match a standard photo tripod. So all you got to do is find one of those around. A lot of people have one; they're not too expensive. Eagle Optics probably sells them.
We do. We have several under $50. I don't think we have one that's quite as inexpensive as the scope, but close to it.
Close to it.
Yeah.
Give us a call, by the way, with your questions. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And the rings of Saturn, Jim, are kind of... We're not going to be able to see those with a Galileo scope very well.
No. Actually, you can see the rings of Saturn when they're visible with a Galileo scope.
Right.
And I did try that early in the summer when we still had a little bit of Saturn left. Saturn is setting right now just about 20 minutes after sunset, so it's deep in dusk even right at sunset. So it would be a real trick to see. But it is interesting because we're right near the Saturn equinox. That is when the ring and the equatorial plane of Saturn align with the sun. So there's no illumination on the rings. If you were standing on the rings, you would just see the sun on the horizon, so to speak. So the sunlight doesn't fall directly on the rings. So of course we don't get any light. We don't see them illuminated from Earth. If we could see it, but and this is the first Saturn equinox since the Cassini spacecraft has been out there. So the really cool thing is there have been a lot of interesting, the astronomy picture of the day, for example, is a good place to follow this kind of thing. And they've had and will be having, I think tomorrow's picture is supposed to be an equinox picture of the rings taken by the Cassini spacecraft. So that's been a really interesting scientific opportunity, but visually is interesting too. But it's hard to see with a telescope right now.
Now people are going to say, what was that again? Where do I go to see?
The astronomy picture of the day is a NASA site. Mm-hmm. And I think it will work to go to APOD, stands for astronomy picture of the day, apod.nasa.gov. I think we'll get you there.
APOD.nasa.gov.
Right. But it's if you just search for astronomy picture of the day, it will pop right up. If you Google for astronomy picture of the day, it will come up.
All right. Let's go to Tom in Milwaukee now. Tom, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Just wanted to point out to people, too, I just got back into astronomy, probably about a year ago. When I was much younger, I had bought a 3-inch refractor telescope. And, of course, everything was all manual. You know, something with a motor drive was really expensive. I bought a new Meade telescope now for a reasonable price that has a motor and it has a computer that will guide you to whatever celestial body you want to go to. And it's really, really been a lot of fun to explore the universe with this new telescope. So I'm really looking forward to what your guests have to say as some of the great events that will be coming up.
All right.
Just thought I would pass that along.
Thanks very much for calling. We'll get comments from both of our guests. Maybe Jim, comment?
Yeah, well, congratulations on the new telescope. It sounds like you're having a lot of fun with it. I guess I'd like to toss out the suggestion that you might want to contact the Milwaukee Astronomical Society, which is the local club, a very active club. And all the astronomy clubs that I know of, always have a really wide range of expertise in the memberships, from people whose closest thing to observing is reading Astronomy Magazine to highly accomplished technical observers. So there's a lot to learn, and they have public programs. And if you're a member of the society, you can get to use their instruments too. So you might want to look at that. But that's really great to hear.
And we've certainly seen that over the past 8-10 years, when the computer add-ons to the telescopes have really expanded a lot of people's, interest when they first get back into the telescopes. So there's a couple of varieties. He didn't mention if his is the style that they call the go-to, where you can literally program an object in and the telescope will move for you. But there's some even slightly less expensive versions where you'll move the telescope yourself, but the computer will be telling you what you're pointing at. So there's even, under $400, some nice options for some fairly good optics with computers built onto them that you can guide yourself around the night sky with.
Boy, for under $400.
Yeah. Orion Telescopes has some interesting ones. Like I say, they won't be motorized to move the scope for you.
Yeah.
But, that's the object for these simpler mounts. The Dobsonian mounts in particular is one, I think, that is what I'm remembering reading that was quite inexpensive, under $400 or $500, but has a complete star map with all the objects in it. And it will guide you to them by telling you how to move the telescope.
Boy.
So you save on the motors a bit, but the computerization's all there.
Paul in La Crosse, it's your turn now. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Yeah, I was saw something in the paper about a WASP project. It's one of those huge planets orbiting a more a even larger sun, and it's sort of in a death wobble right now. It's sort of in a death spiral, and it's going to crash into the sun, and then they said that isn't going to happen for a million years. So yeah. How are they able to figure this stuff out, and why can't it happen sooner?
I want to watch. I know that.
I don't think I'll be around for that one.
First of all, let's clarify. They're not talking about our sun, but this other star, right. This distant star, its sun that this planet is orbiting around. Let's see. So the question was, why can't it happen? Well, we'd have to wait a little bit longer. It takes a certain amount of time. If the scientists are right about what's going on there, then this planet is orbiting very close to its sun, and the primary way that the planet will lose energy is because of the tidal interactions. Just as, in fact, the interaction between the Earth and the Moon is causing the moon's actually robbing energy from the Earth and receding in its orbit. But it can happen the other way, that a satellite's orbit degrades because of tidal interactions. So that's probably what's happening, is this planet, because it's so close to its sun, is losing a lot of its orbital energy as it orbits the sun through the tidal interactions. So it spirals, and it robs just a little tiny bit of energy every orbit. What they've done is they've tried to estimate how fast that's happening, but the system's only just been discovered. So who knows? We may see new numbers come out this time next year, and maybe it will happen sooner. So we can that would be an interesting thing to see, wouldn't it?
Maybe only 100,000 years.
Yeah, maybe.
You never know.
Yeah, astronomical timescales, of course, are different from human timescales. You have to remember it takes like 200 million years for the sun to orbit the center of our galaxy once. So galaxies and stars don't change much over human lifetimes.
Thanks a lot for calling, Paul. I appreciate it. Our guest today, Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, Tom Hall of Eagle Optics, as we talk in this International Year of Astronomy. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking astronomy today with Jim Lattice and Tom Hall, Jim of the UW Space Place, Tom Hall of Eagle Optics. Margo in La Crosse has a question or comment. Margo, hi.
Hi. A couple years ago, we got just a basic Meade telescope, and one of our cats decided to get on it, and he broke pieces off of it.
Okay.
Where can I find some place to have somebody look at this to see if it's... I don't think the main piece is fine, but there are attachments, et cetera, that are in pieces now.
Well, we can look at them at Eagle Optics out there in Middleton, Wisconsin for you, but you could also contact Mead customer service, although, you know, describing these over the phone might be might be a little difficult for you. But which model of Mead telescope was it that you'd gotten?
I don't recall right off the top of my head, but it's just a real basic one. It's not motorized or computerized, just a...
So the 60-millimeter size refractors, perhaps, one of the long blue-tubed... Gotcha. Oh, yeah, we might even have some spare parts from not necessarily Mead models, but we have an array of pieces that we've acquired over the years that might get some of those together. And we might at least be able to, you know, piece together what you still have to get you an image for, you know, for the eyepieces and that sort of thing.
Okay. So I just give you guys a call or?
Oh, sure. Or like I say, you can just swing by and we can have a look at those.
You need another cat to distract the first one.
I think that was the problem. Thank you.
Thanks, Margo.
Good
Thanks
luck.
A lot for calling. Paul in Clintonville, we're on to you. Hi, Paul.
Well, good morning to you.
Morning.
What fun is this?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
It already. Hey, I was reading a little piece on the net the other day about the whole Voyager series satellites. I'd forgotten how many of them there were. But anyway, they said that at least one of them was sitting on the edge of our solar system with, you know, a fantastic number of miles away from here. I'm curious, is this thing still broadcasting data? If it is, how long would it continue to broadcast? Did it ever have a camera? That kind of thing. And also, if it is not broadcasting anything, how in the world can they ever track it? And what kind of equipment down here is so sensitive that it can do that? And I guess that's a boatload of things, and I'll just be quiet and listen. And thank you very much.
All right, thanks for calling.
Yeah, that is kind of a list. But so let's see, real quickly, the Voyager spacecraft that you're thinking of, there were two of them that were sent out in the 70s. At some
70s,
point.
Yeah. Nuclear-powered,
that's right.
Essentially.
That's, which is the reason you can pose this question. Yeah, the nuclear-powered spacecraft, right, that flew out, and they flew by Jupiter and Saturn. They did gravitational slingshots by these planets, and they certainly had a wide range of instruments on them, including cameras. So some of the first good pictures that we got back of the outer solar system planets came from the Voyagers, and they had to be nuclear powered because out there you can't power them by solar panels the way we can when they're closer in, like Martian probes or Venus probes are often solar powered. So they both, in flying by and doing gravitational slingshots by the outer planets, acquired enough speed, more than we could give them with rockets, so that they can actually escape the sun and fly out of the solar system. So these things will escape the sun's gravity and keep on going and wander through the galaxy. And I forget which one it is, but they are still getting signals back from whichever Voyager it is that's still sending back signals. As long as it has electricity from the nuclear power and as long as the radio transmitter is strong enough, then we can pick up signals from it. And what they hope to do, the reason they've left it on, normally they would turn something like that off once its mission is accomplished. But it is, as you say, they're hunting for the edge of the solar system, by which they mean the place where the sun's magnetic field weakens to the point where the dominant magnetic field is the galaxy's magnetic field. And they can see that shift in the magnetic field. And the challenge is to find out how far the sun's influence in the sense of its magnetic field and solar winds extends. That's what they usually mean when they talk about the edge. It's actually flying through that edge. It isn't going to, it's not hanging there. It's not going to fly out and stop or something. It has to keep on going. But that's what the Voyager is looking for.
And you may remember they had the marker plate on both of those spacecraft that had a small model of the solar system printed onto it.
I think that was the Pioneer.
Was that the Pioneer?
The Voyagers had the record. Remember the...
That was what I was getting to, was that there's a joke supposedly going around NASA about the gold-plated record that is on the Voyagers, that they got a signal, the first one that they ever got back from space, that was, send more Chuck Berry. but yeah, those have... I thought that also had the map of the solar system with the male and, you know, its size of a human form and what our solar system looks like.
Maybe that was out on the Voyager,
I'll have to
too.
Look that up now.
It was definitely on the Pioneers.
Oh, Paul, thank you. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, with your question or comment, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. We have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. Ken in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Ken.
Hey, hi. Good morning, folks. Yeah, that Chuck Berry story is no joke. But no, this is another equipment question. I bought one of the Galileo scopes. I was always under the impression that a refractor had an upright image, that it was the way, upright, the way it's supposed to be instead of upside down, upside right or something. That's obviously not the case, as the Galileo scope is an upside down image. Where did I go wrong on this? If one were to buy a refractor, would you specify that you wanted the image to be right side up?
No, you're normally correct, but only in that most refractors, like the one the woman described here a little earlier, has a 90-degree diagonal attached to the back so that the eyepiece is presented in an upright position if you're tilting the scope upward at the sky. That also has the effect of being a mirror, essentially, or a glass prism, doing the same thing, of reversing the image so that it becomes upright. There's still one quirk to those styles of telescopes. All it does is flip the image upright, but it's still reversed right to left. So even if you got one of those, if the star is tracking off to your right-hand side, you, as you see it in the eyepiece, you push the scope left to keep it going. So there are image erectors that you can add to the back ends of telescopes to make the image correct, both right and left, and so that print reads right, and so that the image is upright. But for most astronomical purposes, you're not necessarily going to care because, the image is there. You're able to see Jupiter or see Saturn, and you don't particularly care if it's flipped. The other advantage, frankly, to that is that you're not adding elements in the optical train, which every time you add a little something in there, it will muddy the image.
Yeah, you lose some light. Now, in the case of the Galileo scope, you do have an option to put together what they call a Galilean eyepiece. And if you look in the instructions there, the best ones, by the way, are online. Ones that come in the box are not so hot, but you can go to the galileoscope.org site and download much better instructions, fully illustrated and all that. And if you put together the Galilean eyepiece and put it in there, then you'll get an upright image, which is what Galileo had, but you'll find that you don't like it very much. Galileo struggled with a really narrow field of view, poorly illuminated. And so the designers of the Galileo scope included that as an option so you can get a little bit more of the authentic Galileo experience. But you'll find you like the modern optics better, I think, pretty fast, even though that's an upside-down image.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. I was showing the Galileo scope to some relatives on Saturday, and we had a little get-together at our home, and he was looking out at the across the lake and saw, he said, the sailboat's upside down. I said, well.
Sorry, it's an astronomical telescope.
There's nothing you can do about that. Oh, boy. John and Madison, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. See, I always look forward to the Pleiades, and this year the sky was clear. I got out on the deck in a lounge chair with a blanket about 9 o'clock, and I stayed till after midnight, and there's a possibility I might have dozed off somewhere. But anyway, I was looking southwest, and I never saw a single thing in the sky. Am I looking in the wrong direction?
Sorry. You said Pleiades. Did you mean the Perseids? You mean the meteor shower?
Yes, that's what I meant to say. Yes, right.
Hard to say. It's true. What night were you out near the peak of the shower?
The peak. Yeah, they told me that would be the peak. I don't remember what day it was.
Yeah, 13th or so.
12th or 13th, right?
Well, I mean, this year was not the best year for the Perseids because the moon was bright.
Very bright.
And so most of the meteors, if they rate the Perseids at typically 60 per hour or something, that's including even very dim ones. So if the moon is out, that kind of raises the background, the bias, and I don't know by what fraction, but a substantial fraction of the meteors become invisible because they're not bright enough to outshine the scattered moonlight. So you were competing with the moon this year.
I did see a few, but not a huge number. Someone told me that if you had night vision goggles, you would see many more.
Wow, technically true, but the field of view on those is so narrow, you have to have it pointed in the correct spot before it trails through your view, I would think. But yes, they magnify, whatever you're looking at night, 1,000 or 10,000 times, depending on the generation of the night vision.
I was wondering if this was IR or infrared
No, it's essentially just a detector, a CCD detector with an amplifier to it. But
never thought of trying that.
The field of view is only a few degrees across. So
I'll have to wait till next year.
And we wanted to ask though too, where was your observing site? You were just sitting out in the yard in town, or
yes.
Well, that's going to hurt you too, unfortunately, because some of the background glow from street lights and sodium lamps from the malls and all of that also contributes to not being able to have enough background contrast to see them track through. But you get better at it with a few times going out every year. You kind of learn to look for your peripheral vision and not look right at one section of the sky, but you just kind of let your awareness spread out to the sides, and when you pick them up, you kind of look over and you'll notice that they still glow for a second or two. You'll certainly see some if you get out once a year and try for that meteor shower.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. And I probably commented on this in the past, but in November, being in northern Wisconsin, in the Shawamigan and the edge of the Shawamigan National Forest, and watching at night,
the Leonid meteor shower.
I mean, it was unbelievable the number that we saw that.
Yeah, we get that right before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
But a few years ago, was it four or five years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, we had some really great Leonid showers.
Oh, it was
early
fantastic.
Part of the century.
And those are noted for being, in general, brighter, although not as high a count per year, from what I remember, but noted for being quite bright and sometimes slower, so people pick them up a little easier.
Yeah, in terms of number, they're a little less reliable. Yeah. We get fewer now, but they do come in these storms every 30-odd years, and that's what we were going through, a peak of these meteor storms.
And there no buildings around for miles and miles.
That's so the way to do it.
That was perfect. Yeah. Thanks, John. Larry and King, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Good afternoon, or good morning.
Morning.
My question is, I have a friend that is very interested in stargazing, and he lives in an area where there is no background lighting, and these motorized and computerized and programmable telescopes is it possible, because of his physical limitations, to have that remote controlled and be able to watch it on your computer?
Yes, actually. And the Madison Astronomical Society has set up a couple of those scopes over the year, where you can either do remote viewing from the building at the Astronomical Society's site and just control the scope from within the building and look at a computer screen for its imager. And that's where they will put, again, a charge-coupled device or a CCD camera on the back of the scope and feed the signal elsewhere. You can be observing off-site. It's possible to do. I would say to hit that kind of complexity, he's going to be talking about a bit of an investment. Probably at least in the $2,000 range. I can't imagine getting a good enough imager and an accurate enough scope that, you can either set up permanently and have a little roll-off shed or something. That part of the deal with the computerized telescopes is that you need to align them. And if he's going to try to align them with some physical difficulties every time he goes out with it, a lot of people mount these permanently and then just roll off a shed or a roof or a small observatory of their own, if you will, so that they can get right to observing, or that the initialization of the computerized controls is minimized somewhat. You don't have to go through the alignment procedure quite as hard each time, but it can certainly be done. And there's a lot of people that have done it. And I would say, again, you could contact Milwaukee Astronomical Society or Madison Astronomical Society, as there's several examples that these people have done over the past few years.
Mm-hmm. I see. Is that something you would sell at your store?
No, not at our store personally, and in particular for the charge-coupled cameras. That's kind of a specialized item, but they have them at several of the larger mail-order telescope operations. Orion Telescopes, for instance, is a nice, reasonable one where he can get these go-to scopes and the cameras, the camera itself for less than $500, for an example they have. And sometimes these will also be able to do astrophotography for them. So you can record the images, not just look at them on a computer screen necessarily, but you can essentially take pictures with the imager itself. Mm-hmm. So I would try telescopes.com. That's Orion Telescope. telescope.com. I think they do both, even, or Orion Telescope. And
the plural one used to be a less reputable place.
But, oh, there you go.
but maybe they've switched.
TriTelescope.com, and they're a nice source. And there's several out in California, Woodland Hills Cameras, that sort of thing. There's one in New York that's well-known, B&H Photo. Any of those can be good sources for the cameras and the computerized scopes themselves.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Some emails in. I want to get, and by the way, you can still join us at 1-800-642-1234 with your question. Here's one from Bill in Madison, and he references Laura Erickson, who's been a well-known commentator on bird watching, and I've had her, Laura, on the show many times. At her website, lauraerickson.com, she talks about binoculars. She said that more magnification does not necessarily mean better imagery. This is similar to, maybe not the same as, more pixels in a digital camera does not lead to better pictures. Rather, she indicated that it might very well be far better to buy for the same price a 6X pair than a 7X or 8X pair if the 6X pair is brighter. Would you comment on that?
Well, that's often the case, actually, that there's a trap you fall into, and it happens with telescopes also, for small aperture telescopes. But for binoculars, the same holds true. You fall into the trap of thinking more magnification is better. And quite frankly, the opposite is often true. The more magnification you ask out of an optical system, the more you degrade the image. Mm. We tend to draw the line at about 8 or 10 power. You know, if you can keep below 8 or 10 power, we're perfectly happy with somebody trying to do that. 6 or 7 power binoculars with large apertures, yes, will probably have the sharpest and brightest images that you can get. A lot of people try to go to 12 and 15 power binoculars, and anything past 10, and for that matter, a lot of 10 powers, become hard to hold steady. You degrade the image just because of the shake of your hands. Like you say, when you want to take the Galileo scope out, you have to brace it against something or put it on the tripod to be able to use it. So we would certainly agree with Laura that if you can keep your magnification down, you might be surprised. The image size is slightly smaller, but the resolution is much better, and you will pick out more detail.
Hmm. Heather in Appleton emailed in to say, I ordered a Galileo scope back in May, but I haven't yet received it. Have any other listeners been having this problem? The website is inaccessible at the moment. Do you know of any other context? And thanks for your help. Well, I was trying to remember when I ordered mine. It was a long time ago. And in fact, I'd forgotten about it. And one day it arrived in the mail. And oh, my goodness, I'd forgotten I'd ordered it.
So you ordered yours off the website?
Yes.
Yeah. I thought so. I've heard from other people who've gotten their Galileo scope having ordered it off the website. That's unfortunate that she hasn't gotten hers. I think they were filling orders in the order in which they came in. So maybe she was down far enough in the queue.
And the website, though, still is up.
I just pulled up the website.
Yeah, there we go. So hopefully you can
contact
them.
Yeah. Yeah, in their defense, it's a very small organization. And so we've had trouble. We've ordered large numbers of them from them. And we've gotten the telescopes we've ordered from them. But it's always very difficult getting information about the status of your order and things like that from them, because it's a really small and a nonprofit organization. So all I can say is be persistent, and probably your telescope will arrive.
Yeah, I had, as I said, and someone else phoned in one day and said, when I explained that on another show, another person called in and said, same thing happened to me. I ordered, and then I'd forgotten I'd ordered them, and then suddenly it was in the mail many months later, because I just got mine about a month ago, and I'm sure it was probably May when I ordered it.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's still hope, Heather, but you can, the website's up. So go take a look.
And we do have them here in Madison as well at Space Place. You can buy them right over the counter.
Yeah, at UW Space Place for what are they? Over
$15.
$15 over the counter. I think I paid $20 by ordering them off the site. Eric in New Glarus, we go to you now. Hi, Eric.
Yeah, hi. Really enjoying your show.
Thank you.
I live in a country on a hill, which makes for some great nighttime viewing. And last summer, I saw a really fantastic light in the sky. Figured I was making first contact, probably. And but it turns out someone told me it's maybe an Iridium flare or an Iridium satellite. Does that sound right?
Oh, yes. They're somewhat common. For that matter, you can go to a website, heavensabove.com,
heavens-above.com.
And they have an Iridium satellite tracker. The reason that those are so bright is that they have a huge solar panel array. And the particular makeup of that array is such that when it's tilted just right after the sun has set, and you'll usually find the brightest appearances of these to be shortly after sunset when the angles work right and when they can reflect off the huge panel array, but they're extremely bright. They become the brightest object in the sky, and they only flare up for sometimes a few seconds, maybe sometimes as long as 10 seconds you'll see them flare brightly, and you can track them for a little before that and a little after. But the Heavens Above website will give you the exact times that you can see, and there's, I believe, 30-some of these satellites in the system. But they'll give you an exact time, tell you which Iridium satellite it is. You input your latitude and your longitude, and you can go out at a specific time and look for them, you know, deliberately. And they they give you the apparent brightness level so you can look for the better ones, too.
Sometimes they're bright enough to see in the daytime.
What are those satellites used for? Are they different companies? Are they government satellites?
It was originally a satellite telephone system that went bankrupt, and I don't know what the current status is.
I think they still use them as a communication array. They sold out to some other consortium that still uses the bandwidth.
Well, thank you very much for the information.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, there's lots of events coming up. I know you're going to be going to Italy with a group, Jim.
Yeah, we've planned a great trip with the Wisconsin Alumni Association, sort of inspired by the International Year of Astronomy, called Galileo's Italy. So we're going to go to Italy next April and tour a bunch of history of astronomy sites. This will not be your typical Italy tour. Even if you've been to Italy, we're going to go to astronomical sites and places where Galileo had great triumphs in his life and places where he had great troubles in his life and some really great museums. It's going to be a good trip. So the Wisconsin Alumni Association is the place to go for information about that.
And Washburn Observatory opens up in Madison on the 2nd of September?
Right. We're resuming our our scheduled public nights on the 1st and 3rd Wednesday nights, weather permitting. And there'll be a public open house of the observatory on September 11th from after 2 p.m. So people can come
2
to 4. That's right. So people can come up and take a look at the newly remodeled observatory. And I expect to be up there, so we'll be leading some little tours around to see the observatory in the daytime.
And moon over Monona Terrace, September 25th.
Right, that's Madison Astronomical Society's big event, and that'll be up at Monona Terrace. They collaborate with Space Place and Monona Terrace on that. Lots of telescopes out there on the terrace, and we'll be selling Galileo scopes there as well, as we will at the observatory too on the 11th.
Perfect. Guys, thank you so much. We'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry.
Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, faculty associate in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. Space Place located on South Park Street in the Villager Mall in Madison. Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics. And, of course, Eagle Optics is located in Middleton, Wisconsin. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's usually the way it works. We'll have them back, though, and we'll do this again. Coming up, we're going to stay with the skies, talk climate and weather next with our two weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, here on the Ideas Network.